What I wonder what your view of God is. What do you think he is like? For some people, let me rephrase this. I think many of us have a view of God which is far, far too small. Think of the person who views God as nothing more than a professional therapist, someone who's there to hear all your troubles and to help you navigate life's trials and troubles. Is that a big enough God? Or think of the person who views God as nothing more than a comic book superhero. You know, when we're in trouble, we cry out to help for him, hoping that he'll come and save the day, while the rest of the time we don't think much of him. God's bigger than that. Or the person who sees God as nothing more than an Amazon checkout basket. And if you really like, Amazon Prime checkout basket, where we ask him for something and hope that it will come the next day. God is too big for that. Now, a true view of God's being and character will make us realize that he is far greater than we could ever possibly imagine. A true view of God's being and character will not just affect corners of our lives, but will affect the totality of our life. It will not just change the way we do things on Sunday, if indeed it does change anything on a Sunday. But a true view of God's character and being will change every moment of the week. As we've been reading the book of Exodus, we've seen that that God's people are in a load of trouble. They've been enslaved in the land of Egypt under a cruel dictator referred to as Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, and they have suffered appalling violence under his hands. Their babies have been killed. They have no rights. They're not seen as first class or even second class citizens. We saw an Egyptian soldier beating one Hebrew to the point of death in chapter 2. They seem to be a people without hope and without help. Even Moses, who tried to rescue that Hebrew man from death and succeeded in doing so, failed in that he then committed murder and ended up being shunned not only by Pharaoh, whose house he was living in, and by the Egyptian people, but also by the Israelite people, who would not have him rule over them. They were without hope and without help. Well, Moses would go on to spend 40 years as an exile, tending the sheep of his father-in-law. But in Exodus 3, we read about the day when everything changed for Moses, when he gained a true perspective on the being and the character of God. And everything changes. And so as we look at this passage, we'll begin with Moses, hopefully to gain a true understanding of who God is. Who God is. And I want you to notice two main things that we learn about God from this part of the Exodus story. Firstly, we see in Exodus 3 that God is above us. God is above us. Now, as the chapter opens, Moses, he's going about his ordinary daily work. He's a shepherd. He's tending, he's keeping the sheep of his father-in-law. He's away from home. He's leading the flock through a wilderness area. And he comes to a place called Mount Horeb. Now, the narrator tells us that Mount Horeb is the mountain of God. And it will be later referred to as Mount Sinai, the place where God appeared to Moses and spoke with him and gave him the Ten Commandments to deliver to the people of Israel. The Mount Sinai, which we read about in Hebrews chapter 12, a place where as God descended onto it in a thick cloud, there was thunder and lightning and fire and the earth was quaking. And this will be the place that Moses returns to later with the children of Israel after escaping from Egypt. But right now, it's just Mount Horeb. It's just the place that Moses likely already had some idea about in that region as a shepherd. But this time, this is not a day like any other. This time, Moses sees something extraordinary as he passes by Mount Horeb. We read in verse 2, "And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed." It was not consumed. Now, surely for Moses, wandering around in the wilderness for 40 years with his father-in-law's sheep, it would have been a common sight for Moses to see shrubs and bushes that had caught on fire and were burning away. But there's something different about this one. Because what was especially strange was that this bush, though on fire, did not seem to be affected. It did not seem to be shriveling away. Nothing normal was happening. Not long ago, in a particularly hot summer, one of my shrubs caught a little bit of fire, and the plant never survived. It was gone. That's what happens, isn't it? If a plant has fire, goes near it, it's going to wither. It's going to die. But not this bush. This bush is fine. And what's happening? We're told that the fire was a manifestation of the angel of the Lord himself. Now, this is no ordinary angel. We need to understand this as we read through Exodus and through the Old Testament. There are angels in the Bible, and they are created beings. But the angel of the Lord, when you come upon him, is not a created being. It is very clear, and we'll see in this passage it's very clear, that the angel of the Lord is an appearance of God himself. In other words, it's a title for God in the Old Testament. And so as Moses turns aside to get a closer look, there are two lessons he learns about God's nature. Firstly, he learns about God's holiness in verses 1 to 5. As soon as he tries to go near to have a good look at what is going on, God calls to him. Do you notice the narrator tells us that it was the angel of the Lord who was in the flame, but it's God who speaks. The angel of the Lord is the Lord. As soon as he goes to the bush, God calls to him to stop, to pause, to go no further. Imagine if there were the John who was on the door this morning, as you were walking up the path, called before you got to the door and said, "Stop, don't come any further." You'd be quite taken aback. Some of you would keep walking, wouldn't you, because you like that. You keep on going. Or would you stop? And he says, "You're coming into a holy place." Oh, some of you, your theology is going, isn't it? You're now going, this building is not a holy building. It's not a holy place. What's special about this building is not the building. And you would be right. But you're also wrong. Because here, as God's people, he promises to be here. He promises to be among us. Do you believe this, do you? That as we gather together, God is here? I hope so. And so John would be quite right to say, stop before you proceed any further. Do you realize God is in this place? Do you realize the Lord is manifest here? This is holy ground. Take off your shoes. Not because the ground is holy, but because the Lord is holy. That's what's going on here with Moses. The ground beneath his feet is holy, not because it's a special place, but because that is where the Lord has come down. That is where God has chosen to reveal himself to his servant. This is a special moment, just as every time you gather with God's people is a special moment where God is present. It's a holy moment. And holy simply means to separate, to come apart, to be distinct from what is common, what is ordinary. In other words, God is saying to Moses, this is my territory. Do you realize the holiness of God? Have you been struck by the holiness of God? That he is altogether separate from sinners. He is altogether separate from anything unclean and unlovely. He is unlike us in every way. We cannot imagine him. And we cannot casually stroll into his presence as though he is nothing or it is nothing to do so. This is a God who is not only altogether unlike us, but who is in his holiness morally perfect in every way. How can you possibly think to enter his presence and be welcome in his presence? I remember a friend of mine who visits prisons and shares the gospel. And some of you have heard this before, but I remember him speaking to a prisoner who was justifying his own goodness. How did he do it? Well, he did it the same way as you do. You compare yourself to others. This prisoner was saying that he has committed murder. He was in prison for a life sentence. But he's not as bad as the people on the other wing. You know who the people on the other wing are, don't you? The sex offenders. I may have murdered someone, but I'm not a sex offender. We come into church. We come into God's presence and we think, I'm an all right person. Unlike my neighbours, I'm going. Unlike others, I'm here every week. I'm going to be at two services today. We could go on, couldn't we? I dare not, in case you get annoyed with me too much. But my shirt is ironed better than others. That sort of thing. And yet we shouldn't compare ourselves to each other. We should compare ourselves to God. Then we'd have a real perspective. Who would dare to enter his presence of moral perfection, of spectacular holiness, of unrivaled greatness? How can we expect to come near to him? Well, Moses learned a second thing about God. And though he is so far above us that the theologians call it transcendence, he is just out of reach from us. He also learned about God's graciousness. Because when God tells him, I'm the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, Moses now hides his face in fear. You know, the angels in the presence of God hide their face in fear. It's astonishing that we're not all on the floor cowering, isn't it? He hides his face in fear from his new awareness of the Lord's holiness. And it's at that moment that the Lord delivers some good news. From being far above us, he says, I have seen the affliction and the suffering of my people. But not only have I seen, I have heard their cries for deliverance as their taskmasters have mercilessly beaten them. And not only has he seen and has he heard, but he says he's come down. The God who is in the highest heights of heaven comes down at the cry of his people to save them from their oppression under Egypt's king. And he is going to free them. He is going to bring them into their own land where they will have safety and security. Verse 10. He's going to do this through Moses. Moses, you remember last week, the failure. Moses, the guy who gets it wrong. Moses, the guy who had to flee from Egypt because he was rejected by the Egyptians and the Israelites. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. Moses, I'm going to do this through you. What, the coward hiding in the corner? The guy who is so scared that he's to be confronted by God that he is hiding his face as any one of us would. God says, I'm going to use you. I could do it myself. Be under no illusion about that. He could do it himself. But I'm not going to do it myself. I'm going to use you, Moses, to lead the people out. Do you find that staggering? That God would use someone like Moses, that God would use someone ordinary, someone who's failed, someone who's messed up, someone who ran away, someone who cowers in fear at the presence of God. He uses you. He uses you. You know, like the bush, God's... And isn't a bush such a wonderful picture of what's going on here? Because like the bush, God's fierce holiness should consume anyone who would try to draw near to him. And yet, like the bush, God graciously withholds himself so that Moses is not consumed. And the God who met with Moses then is the God who meets with us today. He is so holy that there is a sense in which how dare we think that we may enter his presence and sing his praise and worship him as though it's a light thing, and yet he does not consume us, but he draws near. He is the God who the angels of heaven hide their faces from, and yet he invites you and me to come. So come as you are to worship him. In the children's book, The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, C.S. Lewis captures this brilliantly. During a conversation with Mr. Beaver, the Pevensey children hear about the lion Aslan for the first time. If you're unfamiliar with The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, Aslan is a picture of Jesus. And hearing that he's a lion, Susan, the older child, questions whether it's safe to be around him. And Mr. Beaver, he answers her like this. Safe? Who said anything about safe? Of course he ain't safe. Of course he isn't safe, sorry. Am I adding to C.S. Lewis? Of course he isn't safe. But he's good. He's the king, I tell you. Don't you think for a minute that God is safe. But he is good. He is good. And so we can approach him in public, in private. We can cry to him and call to him and ask him to come to our help. And he hears from heaven and he sees your situation. And he's willing to come down to help. What a God. God is above us. But secondly, we see that God is among us. God is among us. It's clear from Moses' response to God that his past failures are continuing to haunt him. We read verse 11. But Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt?" Who am I? Have you ever been in a conversation with someone and they've been asked to do something and they're saying to you, I don't know why they've asked me. Why me? I can't do this. And I wonder what your response was to them. Was it, of course you can do this. Of course you can. You'll be fine. You remember that time when... How did you respond to them? What would you say to Moses? Who am I to do this? Would you reassure him that he simply needs to believe in himself? That he just needs to, you know, get on with it and go because everyone else is rallying behind him and everyone else believes in him? Well, let's see how God responded. He answered Moses with the promise of his presence. Verse 12 to 14. Do you notice God didn't respond to Moses by trying to convince him that he can do this all by himself? He doesn't even correct Moses when Moses says, well, who am I? God doesn't say, well, of course, you know, you'll be all right. No, God simply says, I'll be with you. Who am I? I will be with you. Moses is thinking about himself, but God wants him to think about him. Who am I? I will be with you. I am the God of your forefathers. I am with you now. Well, who are you? What will I say to those who ask me who has sent me? I am who I am. Now, what a name is that? I am who I am. Well, this is an incredible name for the Lord. It's a word that we don't really know how to pronounce in the Hebrew. It only has the consonants, which is YHWH. And so what did happen in history, and some of the older Bible translations will write Jehovah. That's a mispronunciation. It's an error. It shouldn't be at all pronounced like that. The closest we think is the pronunciation is Yahweh. But because this name was treated with such high regard by the Jewish people and by those who wrote, who translated the scriptures, who pointed the scriptures, they added the vowels in. They added vowels into that name that would cause the reader to pronounce the name as Adonai, which is Lord, which is why you have in your English translations, anytime you see this name Yahweh appearing, it is Lord capitalized, L-O-R-D. It is a most significant name in the Old Testament for the Lord. But what does it mean? Well, it's something along the lines of to be, the verb to be, to exist. It is, I am who I am. In a sense, it's this. It's, I was who I was. I am who I am. I will be who I will be. It is the God who is self-sufficient, self-determining, who depends upon no one except himself for life and for existence. He is the one who decides what he is. You and I don't get to decide what he is, which is why idolatry is such a grievous sin before the Lord, because you and I don't get to tell God who he is. He tells us who he is. And it's also a name that speaks of his presence. He is the God who always has been. He is the God who was with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He is the God who is now with Moses, and he is the God who will forever be with his people, bringing them out of Egypt into their own land. I am who I am is going to be with you, Moses. You're right to feel inadequate. You are a limited being. You have to be dependent upon all your circumstances, and you can't see every option, and you certainly haven't got the power to deal with it. But I am is with you, and I am will make up for anything that you lack. And secondly, he answered with the promise of his power, not only his presence, but his power, verses 15 to 22. You remember when Moses tried to assert his own power? As we said before, it led to murder and it led to rejection. But Moses isn't going to act in his own power now. He's going to act in God's power. And God is going to ensure that the Israelite eldership accept his leadership and they don't refuse him and send him away as before. And it's not going to be simple. Pharaoh's not going to be easily convinced to let the Israelites leave. Why would you let a free workforce go? But God, not Moses, God will strike the Egyptians with such power that Israel will leave even with their plunder. And they won't raise a finger to do it. Moses, your mission is going to be a success because I am with you to work through you for my plans and purposes to save my people. In Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings, I've quoted C.S. Lewis, so I may as well quote his friend Tolkien. Tolkien in The Lord of the Rings writes about the Hobbit. If you don't know what a Hobbit is, come and see me afterwards, I'll update you. The Hobbit Frodo is tasked with destroying the ring of power created by the Dark Lord Sauron. The ring, throughout his journey from Bag End to Mordor, the ring hangs around his neck, and increasingly as the story goes on, it gets heavier and heavier as a burden. It corrupts Frodo. I'm going to get into too much detail if I'm not careful. And it just brings him lots of trouble. And by the time he makes it to the Mount of Doom, he is too weak, where the ring must be destroyed. He is too weak to climb it and to destroy the ring by throwing it into the fire. Well, thankfully, his friend Sam. Anyone who's read Lord of the Rings will instantly smile at Sam's name. Sam is with him. Sam is there and he picks Frodo up and he carries him up the mountain where the ring is destroyed. Moses' task to go and confront the Pharaoh and rescue God's people was far too heavy for him to do on his own. He would not make it. But I Am was with him. And where Moses did not have the strength, I Am did have ample supply of strength. Like Israel, we cannot save ourselves from the tyranny of sin. We couldn't do it if we tried. We haven't got the power. What do we need? What do you need here this morning if you've not yet been saved? You need God to come to your aid. You need to call out to him, cry to him, ask him for his help. And the good news is that God sees you and God hears you and God will come down to save you. If only you would ask. And like Moses, the church can't take the gospel to the world without his presence and power. Moses was commissioned to go to rescue his people. We as a church are commissioned to go out into the world and preach the good news of Jesus Christ and make disciples and baptize them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. But we can't do that. Without the presence and power of God, the mission is too hard. We're too weak. Well, the good news is that in that same commission Jesus gave to his disciples, he promised to be with them and his church to the end of the age. And through him, he will equip us and he will save the lost, even using us. Weak, hopeless, helpless people. He simply requires us to walk with him by faith and in obedience to his word. Are we? Well, as we draw to a close, in Exodus 3, we see what God is like. He is the I Am who is above us and who is among us to save us. But this isn't the only time we see I Am acting, coming down to rescue hopeless, helpless sinners. In the Gospel of John, we see I Am revealing himself not as fire blazing from a bush, but in the person, the man, Jesus Christ. To those who are spiritually hungry for God, Jesus says, I am the bread of life. To those who are walking in spiritual darkness, Jesus says, I am the light of the world. To those who are looking for a way into God's kingdom, Jesus says, I am the door. To those who are seeking someone to lead them and feed them, Jesus says, I am the good shepherd. And to those who are living in the fear of death, the shadow of death looms large in their lives, Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life. To those who can't find their way to God, who have been trying and they've been searching and they just can't seem to get into a relationship with God, Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. God, come through me and you'll find him. To those who want to live a life of spiritual fruitfulness because they're failures and they've got it wrong in the past and they haven't been fruitful and their prayers have fallen to the floor, Jesus says, I am the true vine. Be joined to me and I will make you spiritually fruitful. I will hear your prayers. I will answer your prayers. Walk with me. Jesus is the I Am of Exodus. He is the I Am who appeared to Moses in the burning bush all those years ago. And he is the I Am who meets with us today, who has heard our cries and who has come down to lead us back to himself. You might say, who am I? God says, I am.